when the tape ended, we were talking about one student who was a mathematician.
Exactly.
Didn't complete his degree, but yet...
went on for a PhD. And I remember the instance, because at orientation programs, this was back in the days when we used course cards, the punch cards,
yes,
in the days of the pit and all of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this guy came through orientation and saw the math advisors and saw us. And we had this program worked out that had math, I didn't remember the exact, math 481, math 437, math 833, math 897. And they didn't have class cards for graduate level courses at freshman orientation.
Uh-huh.
So they gave him cards for 400 level courses that matched the other side, and the math people just went, So this guy went on. We also had a thread throughout the earlier years, not so much recently, of Honors College involvement along with testing and the Office of Admissions to take care of special needs of young students. And I remember once at a national conference, I was asked to describe our program for attracting and serving young students, and I said, our program doesn't do that. It attempts to avoid them, but when they get there, we try to take really good care of them.
Uh-huh.
We never went out to recruit young students, so we've had a series of them.
Mm-hmm. Throughout. Now, by young, you're talking about under 17 in terms of age?
I'm talking about younger than that.
Younger, right.
Okay, one of those students, for example, completed first grade, and they bumped him to high school. Okay,
yeah, yeah.
So he was about 11 mm-hmm. when admitted to MSU,
mm-hmm.
and they, of course, wouldn't let him live in the residence hall, so his family moved to the East Lansing mm-hmm. area. But when those kinds, they were not going to admit him, but he was a graduate of a Michigan high school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Chuck Curry, who was then with the Office of Admissions, mm-hmm. and Gwen Norrell, and I convened our little kiddies committee and to figure out what we were going to do with the. We did this every time this happened, and there were maybe six or eight of them, maybe not quite that many mm-hmm. over the years. But Gwen would hire them to work in the testing office where mm-hmm. she could keep an eye on them. And Chuck would work with us in setting all of this up, and I would be the academic advisor. The point academic advisor for the student. So I remember this one student calling me one morning. It was the day of enrollment. And he called me at home at 6 o'clock in the morning and with questions about courses that he was going to sign up for later that morning.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that he really didn't have to sleep much. He was one of those people, you know, 2-3 hours of sleep a night.
That was it. All that needed.
So we were fairly well known for that for quite a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
But we haven't had one recently.
Mm-hmm.
What else have we been involved in? We've been involved in a lot of things, I guess, but other than the honors programming and the academic advising and the working, Jim Pickering's major emphasis when he was director was to expand relations with units and to try to get every department to have a departmental honors program in addition to the Honors College program overall. And I think part of the reason for that was that there were three departmental honors programs on campus that predated the founding of the Honors College, chemistry and English and mathematics. And those, Jim had a fondness for the departmental programs,
mm-hmm.
And so he wanted every department to have a departmental program with a brochure, and that brochure could then be used in recruiting.
Mm-hmm.
It could be used in his AP&R, APP&R, mm-hmm. and all of this. And so we spent a lot of time working with committees from various departments doing planning for departmental honors programs. And there were quite a number that were really established and built up. And then Jim made a run for the deanship in the College of Arts and Letters when Al Hollingsworth was selected. Mm-hmm. Not long after that, Jim left and went to the University of Houston as their, as Dean of Humanities, I think, and later became provost and acting president for a while.
How did the faculty of the university generally respond to these department level programs? Were they supportive, or did you have to build that base? Or
you really had to build it in a lot of instances. In areas like political science, on the other hand, no. It was there was a very key person in the department who worked religiously to build that program because it struck her as something that really ought to be done. Mm-hmm. Ellen Miskevich, who you might see on the News Hour now and then. She's, I forget where she is now, but she's a political scientist with a specialization in, well, it was in the Soviet Union, the politics of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Her husband was in one of the language departments, taught Russian. And when you found a department, like someone in a department like Ellen, that she was full of energy and did all the work, you see. Mm-hmm. But we all had a lot of liaison responsibilities at that time. That's about the time that Jim hired Chitra Smith as associate director. We had been really without an associate director for some time, actually since Dorothy Arata left during Blackington's administration. There was not really an associate director online. I think that Mary Thompson had that title for a while, but Sister Mary was I forget what order, nun, was in charge of doing all of the research associated with the evaluation of the freshman program, entering as freshman. Mm-hmm. But that's about the time Chitra came in. She had been she had just finished up an administrative internship in the provost's office with Dorothy Arata. And when she had completed that, Jim managed to re-slate us for an associate director. And that's about the same time he changed all of the assistant director titles, except mine, to staff advisor. So I got a promotion, but not a change in title. Not a change in title and not an increase in pay. Oh. That's okay. Mm-hmm. So he wanted us to be much more out in the trenches with the other departments in building departmental honors programs, and that was really one of his main objectives.
Now, was this in the late 70s, early 80s? This happened? Or?
Jim must have left the late 70s. Okay. He must have left about 80 or 81, okay. Something like that. Right. And we then had a year and a half with Chitra as acting director. Okay. And it's at that point that Don Lammers was hired. Mm-hmm. And Don had a very long tenure at the Honors College. Until, 98, I believe. Mm-hmm. So he was there, he was director for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. So they did a complete review of the program at Don's retirement and went through a search for, a national search, in fact, for a director. Mm-hmm.
And who followed Professor Lammers?
Ron Fisher, the current director.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there an increased emphasis on international programs at any time during the time when you were there?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes. Once the president announced that it was an institutional objective to achieve a certain, we redoubled our efforts. We put a lot of emphasis on intensive advising. For example, students come in to see one of us. We have, except in the times that we know are going to be extremely busy, they start out with a one-hour appointment, not a 15, 10, 20-minute appointment. Mm-hmm. It's a one-hour appointment. And we've always put a lot of emphasis on talking with them about a range of considerations, including internships and study abroad and those sorts of things. So we've always tried to make it a total advising situation, and telling them at the same time that they have to see other people too if they want to get the best kind of advice. If you're a physics major, you got to go see that physics advisor too. But intensive advising has been one of the hallmarks of the Honest College. I don't know when it was, a number of years ago, the National NSSE Yearbook or something, it's some educational organization, did a whole volume, and one of their yearly volumes was on programs for the gifted in higher education. And the guy who wrote programs for the gifted, and the guy who wrote the higher education chapter, something Gold, I can't remember his last name just offhand, had chosen three institutions to be representative of the what he considered to be the best institutions, that representative of three different models for honors programs, and he had his models ranged basically on in terms of flexibility, and at one end was the University of Washington, where there was an absolutely cut and dried core curriculum that constituted the honors program, and if a student wanted to do that, he does that.
Uh-huh.
Okay. In the middle was a model that sort of, well, at the other end was good old MSNU, which placed a great deal of emphasis on real flexibility, widespread flexibility, and then the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in the middle, which he viewed as having a combination of the best of those two models. But we were identified as the best in the country of the flexibility model, and when you look at that kind of closely, you see that with the flexibility comes a great deal of emphasis you have to put on academic advising, because intensive advising in that context produces great academic programs. Mm-hmm. If you don't have intensive advising and good advising, you don't produce good academic programs, okay? And we've really put that emphasis. We've always had a wide-ranging a core of honors advisors and faculty who teach honors courses and so on, who work with our students very closely. It also requires a kind of student who's different than those that bloom in those other programs. They've got to be inquisitive, and they've got to want to take charge of their own education more than other students do. And I think probably over the years, including today, a significant subset of our students don't really take advantage of the flexibility. They meet the program requirements, but they do it according to somebody's model of what they ought to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not terribly interested in thinking up different things to do, as Roy P. was when he said, I majored in cognitive science when nobody knew it existed. So, and this changes. Generations of students are very different from other generations of students.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the students in the late 60s and early 70s were, to what degree were they politically involved? You mentioned the Vietnam War, and were any of them leaders in that, let's say, the war protest movement? Did you discover that what were some of the effects or relationships between those top students and let's say, anti-war movement?
Our students have always been involved in student government and other activities more, not less, than the average student. The mm-hmm. exception would probably be varsity athletic, mm-hmm. Although I don't know that it's even the case there, because it wouldn't take very many honest college students, given our size, to be varsity athletes, mm-hmm. to exceed that of the student population
right,
as a whole.
Right, right. Right? And so, you mentioned you did have some athletes
who were
again, top students too.
We do every year. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of our Rhodes Scholars was a world-class, was a member of a world-class relay team, very fine Molly Brennan, mm-hmm. who was among our Rhodes winners. She's really been the only real athlete we've had, mm-hmm. quote-unquote real athlete. Mm-hmm. Although Roy P. used to commute when he went home on weekends to the Detroit area, he did so by bicycle. Those were disturbing years. I was still a student, of course, mm-hmm. and I was working full time. But I was taking graduate seminars, evening seminars, in philosophy and in philosophy of education. I was taking some other courses in philosophy because I didn't have an extensive background in philosophy before I came here, so I did quite a number of undergraduate courses just as more or less catch up. Mm-hmm. The campus, our students were probably overrepresented in SDS, for example. I'm going to go blank on a mm-hmm. name again, but the woman who was our second in command at the library for many years, Beth
Shapiro.
Shapiro was an Honors College member and an SDS founder. Mm-hmm. There are lots of examples like that.
Yep. Randy Scott.
Didn't know him.
Okay.
Okay. The African American guy who was in Madison. I come up with it, but lots of them. We did, as part of this new freshman program in 70 and in 70, 71 and 71, 72, we did a freshman seminar, which we would bring in people to speak, and then we had broken down into a large number of small discussion sections, some of which were taught by Honors College staff, some by other faculty, some by students. And we brought in a lot of lefties for that. You know. Phil Johnson, who was one of the other assistant directors, was a sociologist. And Phil was connected, shall we say, in the movements. I did my own share of marching on Grand River Avenue and so on. And I know our students were frequently to be found there as well. So, yeah, we had all kinds. I mean, I remember vividly a young man, not especially political, a young man, I don't remember his name vividly, but yes, sure, I do. Mordecai Abramowitz.
Mort.
Okay. And Mort was from Detroit, and he had attended a very competitive high school, and was a go-getter and really, really competitive spirit. He was a physics major, and after his first year, he decided that he wanted to be in Justin Morrill College rather than be a physics major. Mm-hmm. And the first time he came in to see me, after he had made that change, say halfway through the fall semester, he looked haggard, he looked tired. I said, "Mark, what's the matter with you?" He says, "I always knew when to stop, before. Yeah, get a 4 points, you can stop. Mm-hmm. But I don't know when to stop now. So it was all. We had a lot of students at Justin Morrill who were in the Honors College. We had a separate application procedures for them, the ones who came in by application, because since they didn't grade. Mm-hmm. So we had an arrangement over there. They provided us with the permission of the students with their written evaluations, and they made recommendations themselves. So we had a good working relationship with all of the residential programs. So.
Were you teaching at all during that time?
Yeah, I taught... Before I started at the Honors College, I was a teaching assistant in the undergraduate required course in educational foundations. And then after I moved over to the Honors College, I taught a number of special topics courses in that, one for people who were preparing for certification as teachers of the gifted. Mm-hmm. So I did an Ed Foundations course for them. And I did another one that was, I can't remember the name of the program now, it was a special program in the College of Education. And I taught it one for them. And then I taught it at 801A, the introductory philosophy of education course, mm-hmm. In a lot of places, by extension, mm-hmm. and on campus. And I taught a Plato Dewey seminar a couple of times. That George Free and I used to teach some special topics, grad seminars together. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I kept up pretty much. And then it got too busy and I didn't, after, say, early 80s. But when they started these new freshman seminars, I've been teaching one of those. So mm-hmm. I did last year, but I did the first 2 years or so. Mm-hmm. And this year I'm doing one. I'm going to have the kids look at... the vision of education that's incorporated into Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward.
Oh, okay.
So we'll have some fun with that. Mm-hmm. This is not for Honors College students. This is just a freshman seminar.
Uh-huh. What is it that you've, over the years, that you've liked most about teaching?
Well, I've always liked student contact, and I really consider academic advising a form of teaching, to be quite honest mm-hmm. with you. But what I've liked most about teaching is that it kept me more engaged in my primary subject than I am otherwise. Mm-hmm. I remember one time I was teaching I think it was an 801A, and there was an African-American guy in the class who was in a special program in mathematics, and this was going to be a program for improving mathematics instruction. It was a master's program. And after three or four sessions, he set up an appointment with the office. He said, "I want to sit down and go over some things with you because you don't seem like you're hard-nosed, but I know you are hard-nosed." "So I want to know more about your expectations." And I remember that. I've always remembered that. Because I've been, the people in Ed used to give me these things every semester, fill these out, you know, and they would ask, "What characteristic learning activities are your students going to be involved in?" And I would answer, Reading, writing, and discussing
the tough things.
The tough things. So it's student contact, discussion especially. You get to know people in that context in a much more than otherwise. I mean, I've taught everything. I taught when I was at Missouri. I taught courses at Central Methodist mm-hmm. College, and I taught in our correspondence division, okay. mm-hmm. and I taught on campus, teaching assistant on campus, but mm-hmm. I've always liked teaching. I just taught high school for 2 years, high school American history, mm-hmm. But it was a fun and good 2 years.
In your career, you've seen change, obviously, in students over the years. How would you characterize that change?
in the MSU students?
Well, I think there's the waning and the waxing of political orientation and seriousness about why they're here. And that's very difficult to disentangle which is which sometimes. Mm-hmm. Because I know a generation of students, kids who were here in the 80s, probably early 82 to 86, things like that. These kids were very serious about their educations, and they appeared to be, at least socially, rather conservative. But I've never met a cohort of students that was more committed to doing good with their education than these. Mm-hmm. This was a group of people who include a guy who, I never forget it, at AOP, he came into AOP and he sat down across the table from me and he says, I want you to know before we start talking about courses, I want you to know right off the bat that I'm not an engineer and I don't want to be an engineer. Mm-hmm. And I said, well then why do you have your declared major in chemical engineering? And he said, because I want to work for the Environmental Protection Agency and I don't think that the EPA bureaucrats know enough about engineering and science, and so if I'm going to work for them, I'm going to know what I'm talking about. Okay? I said, fine, let's work on it. So he stuck with me, sort of almost primary advisor for the full 4 years, and I still am in touch with him. I still keep in touch with him. But he, the first task with Tom was to get him to apply for a Truman Scholarship. And we managed to convince him to do it. And he kept saying, it's not for engineers, it's for Madison students, stuff like this. Give it a shot. And it was a tough road to hoe, mm-hmm. but he actually won a Truman Scholarship. And he went to Berkeley when he finished his degree here and did a joint program in public policy and engineering. And he stopped off in East Lansing for a visit on his way back through to Washington, D.C., where he had taken a job with the Environmental Protection Agency. He was in charge of a superfund for a big job for a first job. He was in charge of the superfund program that was to dig up underground gas tanks from abandoned gas stations and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and restore those. And he was with the EPA for a number of years. And he finally went back to school and got a PhD in environmental engineering. He's in, I think, UCal Davis now. I think it's Davis. But we stay in touch by email now and then. Mm-hmm. And but he really characterized that group. They were serious. They were socially conservative in lots of ways, but they were really out to do something. They were not these me first kinds. We'd have me first kinds, of course. I think that less of that than has been claimed. I really do. I think our students at MSU, at least the ones I've known in the Honors College, have by and large been really serious people. Like I said, our first modern Rhodes Scholar who practices law in Fort Wayne is also a labor organizer. He also did pro bono work representing a small town in Indiana where Waste Management Inc. was dumping hazardous materials, and he won. And that's what our people are doing. And they're all over the place. They're in medicine. They're in law. They're profs, they're doing engineering kinds of jobs and all sorts of things. And they're, I think, by and large, good citizens and thoughtful citizens. And I'd like to think that they're all lefties, but they're not. But the ones that aren't are, for the most part, sensible. Mm-hmm. I can name a few well-known exceptions, but I won't.
In looking at some of the alumni of the Honors College, in terms of, you mentioned a couple contacts that you've had, what do you see, is there any way you can characterize their reaction when they come back and either in conversations that they've had with you in terms of what the Honors College has meant to them and their experience?
They had a reunion of the ADSers last year, and a number of them showed up, and it was like old home week. The people who communicate with us, we've had since one of the things that Ron Fisher has done is reorganize the staff rather thoroughly. We now have an assistant director who's Beth German, whose all of her work is related to alumni relations and recruiting. Mm-hmm. So the way we got around the backing off of serious recruiting efforts for out-of-state students on the part of the Office of Admissions and Scholarship was to take on a substantial part of that ourselves. Bess has one assistant, and they spend lots of time.